This is Bob Wilson. Welcome to Don't Pass Me By. How could you pass me by today? Well, you might be able to pass me by, but how could you pass by the legendary Ivor Davis and the legendary William Mattson Law? He was so cool they didn't give him two names, they gave him three. Today we're going to be talking a lot about RFK, Bobby Kennedy, another great hope in our country who is snuffed out, unfortunately. But let's say hello to our first guest. He'll be doing some questioning of Ivor for a new book he has coming up. We don't want to give any spoilers. Welcome to the show, William.
Hey, hi everybody.
So you have the
Hello,
books,
William.
yes, gentlemen, and we have In the Eye of History, At the Cold Shoulder of History, and Betrayal. Those are some very interesting tomes that went along a definite subject line. How did you get involved in that business, sir?
Years ago, I became interested in the Kennedy assassination, and I read a book about it I'd never heard of before that contained the autopsy photographs of President Kennedy. And looking at these things, I thought something is not right about these pictures. So I bought this book, I took it home, I read it, and the thesis was that the president's body had been taken after the assassination and somehow stolen. And a pre-autopsy had been performed on President Kennedy before the official autopsy. And I thought, this is ludicrous. This can't be true. And I just started reading everything I could get my hands on after that. And I just became obsessed with it. I became obsessed with Kennedy and started reading about it. And then I thought, I've been doing this for a number of years. And then the information became repetitive. And so I started actually calling witnesses that had been in Dealey Plaza. And one thing led to another. I went to a conference that I learned about. And I thought, I think I was like 39 at the time. And I thought, this is not normal behavior for a man of my age with kids and a job to be so obsessed about this. So I'm going to go to this conference in Texas. And I'm going to go there. I'm going to listen to the speakers. I'm going to share ideas with people, and then I'm going to go home and I'm going to forget it. And I'm not going to think about this anymore. And while I was there,
We know
I
how
had,
that went.
yeah, I, while I was there, I had lunch with George Michael Ivica, who was helping put the conference on. And I started telling him about how the autopsy was, the medical evidence was the secret to the case. And he asked me to speak about it. And I'd never done any public speaking. I said, well, I don't want to do that. And then he asked me to put on a panel for the next year. And so I found myself sitting in the living room of Gerald Custer 3 months later, asking him about his experiences in the morgue that night while he was taking x-rays of President Kennedy's body. And that's how it all started.
Well, we know how it wound up. You've done some very interesting work there, and we're going to talk more about that subject. And also, welcome to the show, a legend. He has written such books as Manson Exposed, The Beatles and Me on Tour, and Ladies and Gentlemen, The Penguins. Welcome to the show, Ivor Davis. But more than that, I understand you were a soccer reporter. Tell us about your soccer reporting.
Well, soccer is my passion, and good afternoon, William. Nice
Good
to
afternoon.
hear your words. I've got a few questions for you. I'll keep soccer down to 90 minutes, which is the length of a game, if that's all right with Steve.
Yes.
Anyway, I played soccer in England at a fairly semi-professional level, so that was my passion. And then I was able, when I came to the United States, to cover three World Cups. One of them was for CBS Radio, and then the others for local radio. So I am, it's my passion. And as William said, you suddenly become obsessed, and I've always been obsessed with soccer. So I know we only have an hour to talk about how come, teams like Morocco are in the final, but I think we'll probably keep that for the next program. Is that okay?
Well, we're going to hold you to that on the next program. But now, because they're here to, Ivor was actually a witness to history, probably many, I guess I could say many times. He's been in the right place at the right time more than Zelig. But I hand over to William, who has new work on RFK that he'll tell us about. And he'll also get into now talking to Mr. Davis about Robert Kennedy.
Ivor, it's a great pleasure to talk to you.
Nice to talk to you, William. And I did do a little bit of the homework, so I do have some questions for you. But if you want to fire first, go ahead.
Well, I'm just finishing up a new book that I'm calling Shadows in Light, The Murder of Robert F. Kennedy. And, of course, it deals with the assassination of Robert Kennedy, but not in a way that most other people have done it. I teamed with a filmmaker, Mark Sobel, who's done a number of movies and TV movies and things like that. And he was interested in the case, too. And we decided to go down the road and see what we could see. And that's what I've spent off and on. I've spent 17 years doing this. Wow. And so to talk to somebody that was in the pantry that night is extra special for me. And I'd heard your name before, but this is the first opportunity I've been able to have to talk to you. So this is just great.
Well, let me, if I may, take a moment to set the scene. I was a foreign correspondent for the London Daily Express, and we were doing a book which was called Divided We Stand. And it actually did come out. It wasn't too great. But and as a foreign correspondent in California, I was given the assignment of traveling with Bobby Kennedy, which was kind of interesting. And I must say, I was quite impressed with Bobby Kennedy on the campaign trail, only because in the last two or three days, the pace of his travel was phenomenal. And as you probably know already, William, on the day of his death, I mean, I think we started in San Francisco, then we came down to San Diego, and then we came to L.A. I mean, that is enormous. And along the way, Bobby met his constituents all over the place, and his energy was phenomenal. And I must say, I had a hard time. I was much younger then, would you believe? I had a hard time keeping up with Bobby. And I remember I would say at about 4:30 to 5 o'clock in the afternoon of the night the election results were going to come in, I stopped by at the filmmaker John Frankenheimer's house. And he lived on the beach in the Malibu Colony area. And I peeked in, and there was Bobby Kennedy lying on a wicker kind of chair, sitting, you know, in the patio. And he looked as though he was dead. He was so exhausted. And I noticed that his hands, believe it or not, were raw from shaking hands with so many people on the road. I mean, those were the days when you could touch the candidate. Those were the days when you stroked the candidate, you held his hand. And Bobby had done it all. And then let me take you, of course, to the scene that you all know so well. There we were, and McCarthy, Eugene McCarthy, had lost. We knew it. And there was Bobby in one of the rooms at the Ambassador Hotel, and we were standing there, and he was joking about Mayor Sam Yorty, who was the mayor of L.A., who Bobby obviously wasn't too keen about. And then he said something like, and I'm thinking, and now onward to Chicago. And then we were going to have a press conference in another room of the hotel. So we all followed Bobby as he was led through through the kitchen, of course. And as we were, I was about 20 yards behind. And Bobby moved on, and I moved along with the traveling press. And I would say a minute after he left the ballroom to go to the press conference, and I was, as I say, 20 yards, 30 yards behind, I heard balloons popping. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 balloons popping. At least that's what it sounded like. And then I heard screaming. And as the screaming began, I pushed myself to the scullery of the kitchen. And barring my way, and I'd forgotten the guy's name, he was the brother-in-law of Bobby Kennedy, and you would know who that is, William. It was, it'll come to me in a minute. Who?
Sergeant Shriver?
It was Shriver. Yeah, he stood trying to block me from walking into the anteroom of the kitchen, and I actually pushed my way past him. He grabbed me by the shirt, and I kept moving, and this is weird, and he tore the shirt from my shoulder to my cuff. But it didn't bother me. I moved in there, and that at that moment, Bobby, and then I saw the scene, women screaming, Bobby lying on the floor, and Ethel Kennedy sitting by his side. Everybody was screaming and shouting. It was bedlam. And Bobby was there, and Ethel lifted her arm to everybody who was around Bobby on the floor, bleeding. And she was saying, give him air. And the moment was frozen in my mind, because I thought, where is Harry Benson? Harry Benson is the brilliant photographer, legendary now, who was traveling with me for my newspaper, taking pictures. And Harry Benson was standing on the metal desktop or the kitchen top, taking pictures. And his pictures, as I'm sure you know, William, and Bob knows, his pictures are phenomenal. Harry kept firing away. And we were all in shock because there was screaming, there was bedlam, there was nothing you could explain. And there was Bobby bleeding on the floor with Ethel doing what she could, which was not much. There was the young kitchen aide that was helping her. And in another pile, it was like a football pile, was this guy squirming underneath a pile of bodies. Again, Rafer Johnson was on top, and there was the football player who was also Bobby Kennedy's bodyguard. And you, William, will know, and I've forgotten his name, but you know who I'm talking about. So there was a kind of a rugby scrum on one corner of the kitchen, of the anteroom. And the other side, Bobby was dying. And it was just havoc. I can't tell you. And they took Bobby away to hospital. And then we tried to put together what went on. And I would advise you, and you've probably seen this, William, there is some incredible, I think it's ABC News footage of the aftermath of the shooting. And I'm in the picture. Because the people are coming out and everybody's saying, what happened? What did you see? And they said there was a lady with a polka dot dress, and then there was a guy in a business suit who vanished, and the lady in the polka dot dress vanished. I mean, I'm sure you've seen that footage, William. If you haven't, you should.
Oh, yes.
That was it. I mean, we were all in shock and as I say, confusion, what went on, who did it? Who's the guy that under the pile of bodies I think they wrestled the gun away from him. But it was one of those images that is forever etched in your mind, and you play it time and time again and you come away with different things. But that was the moment that I realized that Bobby was in serious trouble. And then we all went to the hospital, and I think, and I'm trying to think, and I haven't thought about this for some time, how many hours later that we were returned to the hospital, and Mankiewicz, I think it was Tom Mankiewicz, his press guy, announced the senator died. And we just sat there. I think everybody was in shock, but we did our job, and we phoned the story in, and some of the facts were confused as those things happened. And I'm sure that you've discovered this, William, when you've gone to, you know, you've gone to the grassy knoll and you've heard stories from everybody who was there. And even to the extent, and I was looking up you when you write about the shooting of Oswald and this guard that was with handcuffed to Oswald. So There's clarity and confusion and many, many opinions. And that's what happens in a situation like that. You get 50 opinions of what happened, and usually only 20 of them are really genuine or really accurate. Anyway, it's like the accident, you know. You see an accident, and you get 6 different versions of how it happened. So I've talked enough. Back to you.
Everybody sees something different, no matter how close they were. Everybody has their own concentration and what they were looking at, so that even people in a room will see the same thing but have different opinions about it. So that was absolutely fascinating. Back up to the beginning of the campaign when you first started. When did you first meet Bobby Kennedy?
I first met Bobby Kennedy, and I think we were up, and I'm not sure why we were in Arizona, but we were at a river. And I have a picture of me sitting next to, or standing next to Bobby. And they'd gone to a recreation river area. And as I say, I haven't really thought about this for a long time, because I haven't actually written about, I mean, I've talked about Bobby's shooting, and I covered the Sirhan trial, or the whole trial. But, you know, life goes on. It's a long time. It's 1969. What year is it? 19, you tell me. 64, 65, 66, 66 or 67. I can't even remember what year unless you pin me to it.
He was shot in 68.
Okay. That was the same year as Martin Luther King was killed. That was the same year the Vietnam War was raging. That was the same year when I tuned on every night on television to see Cronkite and all those people talk about the latest body count of American troops in Vietnam. And a lot of other things happened that year. It was really a pretty horrendous year. So to answer your question, I picked up Bobby fairly early in the campaign, mainly on the Western Hemisphere. And as I said, what I remember with being in San Francisco with him, how he drove through the streets of this open car, and people were there, and they mobbed him like a rock star. He was a rock star. And they all wanted to see him, and they all wanted to touch him. And then we came back to California, and the same thing happened with Bobby everywhere he went. And, you know, he would have gone on certainly to Chicago and got the nomination, I think. I'm pretty sure.
What do you remember about your first meeting where you got to talk to him and size him up?
Well, you know, what happened was we were kind of the boys on the bus. We said hello. And then when halfway through, you know, we were introduced to him. I mean, there was quite a few guys on the bus, quite a few guys on the train. On the train was remarkable, because now that you're triggering my memory, I mean, what was great about the train was we would stop on the train. That's when we got a chance to maybe have a cup of tea or a cup of coffee with him. And he was ebullient. He was charming. He made the same speech every time the train stopped in Central California. You know, he got on, we got off the train. He made the same speech. He quoted George Bernard Shaw at the end. As soon as we heard him quote George Bernard Shaw, and I forget the quote, I'm sure you have it, or you know it, or you can find it. As soon as he said George Bernard Shaw, that was our signal to us to get back on the bloody train, otherwise we'd have been left. So as soon as George Bernard Shaw came up, we jumped on the train, Bobby jumped on the train, and we went to the next stop as we came through California's central agricultural area where Cesar Chavez showed up on one stop. And as you know, and as those who are knowledgeable about that, Cesar Chavez brought his farm worker union power to work for Bobby Kennedy. And the thing, I don't want to keep repeating myself, but the thing that always impressed me was how passionate they were, the people that supported him. San Francisco, San Diego, the central Valley of California, the Ag Belt. Everybody came and were wild about Bobby.
So you got to be with him during this time. You know, and being a reporter, you can get pretty jaded, I would imagine, with politicians. In the time that you got to know Bobby Kennedy, you got to be close to him, you got to talk to him, you got to write about him. Did you find that passion to be real?
I really did. I mean, if he was play acting, he did an Oscar winning performance. I think his passion for what he wanted to achieve. I mean, he obviously wanted to follow in his brother's footsteps. I mean, that's elementary, my dear Watson. But he seemed to be enthusiastic. He seemed to be with the program. I never saw him ever say or feel or indicate that he was going to walk off stage. And it was the same everywhere. He kind of got in the mood. As I said, I think by the time we got to Malibu and that afternoon before the night at the Ambassador, he was so wiped out that he just collapsed. So I
think
the passion.
I only saw him.
We stopped by briefly to, as I say, the film director, John Frankenheimer's house. And as I said, Bobby was lying, it was about 5 o'clock in the afternoon. Bobby was lying in the patio on a chair, so still and so asleep that I thought he looked like he was dead. And once we saw that he was resting, we kind of moved on, and we drove from Malibu to the Ambassador Hotel, which is probably 45 minutes onto where we knew the next leg of the campaign was going to be played out, and the votes would be counted, and we would realize who had won the California primary.
Did you ever get to spend any time with him and interview him by yourself, one-on-one?
No, I did not get one-on-one interviews with him, although there were times, as I say, we were on the river. I remember on the river bank, and I can't remember, I think it was why we were there, I'm not exactly sure. I was there with Harry Benson, who was as I say, the brilliant photographer that had shot a lot of stuff. And Harry also, and I hope you get a chance to talk to Harry. Harry's now in his 90s. He's sort of up and down. His memory is terrific. And, he because he took pictures, I think he became more closer to Bobby and Ethel on that trip than anyone. I mean, photographers do. I mean, they go off and they want exclusive pictures. And I hope you do get a chance to talk to Harry.
Because he will give you
additional insight. Harry's in his 90s now. You know, he's okay. He's pretty good. His memory is good. He has a great sense of humor. And as I say, his memory of that period was pretty good.
Well, since you mentioned her, tell me about Ethel. Did you have any interaction with her?
Well, I mean, the only thing was Ethel was there, and I think she was a Kennedy woman. I mean, she did not impede. She was there. That was the image. And I'm just thinking now, I may be off with my numbers, but Ethel was expecting, I think, maybe the 11th child. I lost count. And so, I mean, Ethel was there, and there was this woman with so many kids. And this was another thing. I mean, what were they trying to do? Create a football team?
When you were in San Francisco, I talked to Freddie Plimpton years ago, and she told me that they were in San Francisco and they were in the car or one of the cars and somebody threw firecrackers in the car. And you could see that everybody kind of jumped, especially Bobby. And then he kind of laughed it off. Did you see that particular incident?
I didn't see that particular incident, but it's kind of a, I mean, I hate to make it a common thing, But the reason, the last time I did see something like that, it wasn't with Bobby Kennedy, it was with John Lennon. Because I was on tour with Lennon, I think it was 66. And in 1966, John Lennon had come up with this quote about, "I'm more famous than Jesus." You know the quote. You've heard the quote, or the words to that extent. And on that leg of the Beatles trip, the Beatles were very nervous, and John Lennon was absolutely terrified. And I forget where we were. We were in, I think we were in the South somewhere. I could look it up. And somebody did light a firecracker because John Lennon was terrified that somebody would try and kill him for his comments. So no, I answer your question by saying, no, I don't remember the firecracker in San Francisco. I remember the parade. I remember going through the way he went through. I'm pretty sure it was in an open car, even though it was, well, mind you, it was late June. Was it June? Late June, I think. So the weather was quite fine. But I didn't see the firecrackers, but it doesn't surprise me whoever told you that the firecrackers went off. I mean, come on, this was not long after Dallas, was it?
Yes. 5 years or so.
Yeah.
So is there anything at this point that stands out to you anywhere along the campaign that you were with him that you consider to be special moments?
What I'm going to do is because a lot has happened since then, and I've just given you generalities, I would like to say, let me think about it, and let's return to this. Let me give it some thought, and let me return to this with you at a different occasion.
Absolutely.
Can I ask you a couple of questions, William?
You may. Anything you'd like.
Okay. I've seen that you said, which triggered your obsession with this whole thing, that you had seen the Zapruder movie, the film. And that was also something that triggered your passion, interest, obsession, if you like, with the whole thing. Now, we've all seen the Zapruder movie, and I wondered what was it in there, the jerking, and then Ethel, and then the guy on the back of the, and again, I haven't seen the film for years, so I'm talking from years. What was it about that film that made you decide to take a long second look?
It was just, you know, the Kennedy mystique and what happened and the mystery behind it all. I remember being 1975, I was 17 years old. And I'd never seen the Zapruder film until Geraldo Rivera's Good Night America program, where he put it on his program and showed it for the first time. And I was absolutely stunned then. That didn't particularly ignite me. I would watch the occasional thing that came on about Kennedy. I remember thinking as a teenager that I'd always been interested in it, but it didn't become obsessive until I saw the autopsy pictures. And I thought to myself, someday there's going to be people that are going to come forward that know what happened. And that's probably going to be the people that had the body. So I'd always kind of had that idea in my head. And then when I saw those autopsy pictures, that set something off in me. I've seen the Zapruder film so many times, I can literally close my eyes and see it. I mean, over and over and over and over. The one thing, and I've stared at those autopsy pictures so much over the years, that although, when I look at a film of John Kennedy, I see John Kennedy, as everybody else does on film, smiling and happy and charismatic. But beside that, I always see him stretched out on that morgue table at the same time. So I've kind of ruined that for myself because I've dealt so much with his death and his autopsy that's really what I see when I look at Kennedy. And that's too bad, but that's really how it is for me. I've dealt with this so long. Everything about it was just fascinating. I guess because I wanted to delve in because I felt that we had lost our hope when he died. Yeah. What I didn't realize is that we really lost our hope when Bobby Kennedy died.
Yeah. Well, the obvious question that is a follow-up is, based on your enormous research, based on your feelings, because you said at the beginning you did not come in as a conspiracy person until you dug deep. So my question obviously is going to be, what about Bobby? Was that another one of we'll get the Kennedys?
I was told when I was doing all this research and putting my first book together, somebody said, you know, you're going to fall in love with Bobby. And while I was doing this research, I had already fallen in love with Bobby. I had a picture of him on my bedroom wall running alongside the ocean with freckles. And I'd had that picture hanging up there. I think it was probably 1970 or 71. Might have been 72. I'd gotten a hold of that picture. So there was just something about him. There was something about the Kennedys that just, it happened with most Americans, I think. You know, people say there was, you have a picture of Jesus and you have a picture of John Kennedy. And I was just kind of, it didn't hold any kind of obsession to me till I was grown and happened to see those pictures. It just activated something in me. And then when I did all that research for my first book, I did fall in love with Bobby Kennedy and I wanted to know more. And I thought after the first book and it was published, I had done some work for a guy, Mark Sobel, who was a filmmaker, on the case that he was doing. And I asked him if he'd like to team up with me because I said, I'm going to do some interviews into Bobby Kennedy's assassination. I said, would you like to come along with me and film some of this while I'm doing this? And he wanted to do a film and I wanted to do a book. And so we started off down this road. And the reason I got into this is I wanted to find out, if I could possibly find out, was Sirhan jerking our chain when he said he couldn't remember? Or was it real? Could he really not remember? Or was it just a ploy? That was the whole thing for me. I wanted to find out what had really happened to him, if I could do that.
But to interrupt you a second, I covered the trial and I did not feel that Sirhan was a great mind. I did not feel that Sirhan was the kind of guy that could be cleverly deceitful. Watching him function, he didn't. I remember he said he'd gone to the Santa Anita, I think Santa Anita racetrack that day. He'd had a few drinks. Maybe that was an alibi, who knows? And that, you know, then he, when he came back from the racetrack, and, you know, you've looked into it more deeply. I haven't thought about it for many, many years. When he came back, and that's when he ended up going to the hotel, but without intent to commit homicide.
Right.
You know, who knows? But the other thing that you said that I saw you write was a line that I thought it was very powerful and quite accurate, because I know in my own mind it is. You said something like, the passage of years has blurred recollections and of details. Now, this is something you found, I presume, and do you think that statement means that people don't remember everything and then have to finish the recollection to whatever they're asked? Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think that people tell you what they know as accurately as they can. And sometimes they forget things, but as they're talking about it or they think about it a little more, questions you ask will jar their memory. And then they will remember more details and it becomes clearer. It's like when I would interview people about the autopsy, they were all in the same room, but they were all concentrating on different things. And so they would remember things, and they all got to know each other through the years as people would interview them, and they still continued to tell their version of their story no matter what the other person said. The details do become blurred, but it can also become clearer depending on if you can jar their memory or not. Everybody's memory is fallible.
Yeah. Okay. Now, it seems like you're putting, and pardon me for my ignorance here, it seems like you're putting a huge amount about the autopsy. Now, the autopsy will tell you where the bullets ended up and how the body was damaged and all the rest of it. Why is the autopsy's contradictions, or maybe there are contradictions, I don't know, I'm not that close to it. Why is the autopsy of John Kennedy so important in your investigation?
Okay. Well, to begin with, after Kennedy died, he was dabbed off, wrapped in sheets, and then they brought in a 400-pound Britannia display casket from the O'Neill funeral home. They put a sheet of plastic over the inside to protect the silk lining from seepage of blood. So they put him in the casket, wrapped in these sheets on top of plastic, and then they closed the lid. They took this casket and they put it aboard Air Force One, and then they had to take some seats out and things to accommodate the casket. Then they took off and went to Andrews Air Force Base, where the casket was taken off and loaded aboard another hearse,
transport a Grey Navy plane.
Well, no, it was loaded aboard a Grey Navy ambulance, and then that was driven 45 miles to Bethesda Naval Hospital. So the thing becomes weird when you interview a man that I interviewed named Dennis David, who was chief of the day there. He said that about 6:35, he was given orders. He was given orders somewhat earlier to unload a cheap metal shipping casket at the back of the Bethesda morgue before the official ambulance, supposedly containing Kennedy's coffin with his body in it, came in. So at 6:35, he gave orders for six or seven enlisted men that he had gathered from around the dental school and things like that on the grounds to take this metal shipping casket and take it inside of the morgue, which his men did. They took this metal shipping casket. You have to go up a few stairs, go through a door, and then you have to go a little ways, and then you go into an anteroom, and then beyond the anteroom is the morgue. They said they took the cheap metal shipping casket into the morgue and put it on the floor, which at that point, Paul O'Connor, whose job it was to remove the brain and do the craniotomy and take the brain out of the head, he said that he and a bunch of other men took the lid off of this metal shipping casket. It was a screw-type lid. You take the screws off, then you remove the lid. And he said inside of the cheap metal shipping casket was a body bag. They unzipped the body bag, and inside the body bag was the body of John Kennedy. The body was nude except for some towels and sheets that were wrapped around the head. And then they placed that on the morgue table there before they did their work. So we've got a few things wrong here. I talked to the two FBI men that were told to stay with John Kennedy's body. They were told by J. Edgar Hoover, stay with Kennedy's body, retain whatever is recovered during the autopsy for evidence, and take it back to the FBI laboratory for testing. So they say that they are the ones that took Kennedy's body at 7:17 into the morgue, and they saw the whole thing, that the lid was open, the body was there, it was wrapped in sheets, but that's at 7:17. But now we go to the honor guard, who says they took the body out of the casket, out of a display casket. They brought the body in at 8 o'clock. So you've got differing descriptions of how the body was wrapped, what times the ambulance came in, how the wounds to the body looked. The at the 6:35 arrival, the wound when they unwrapped the head was a massive blowout. Paul O'Connor told me that it was my job that night to remove the brain, perform the craniotomy, which is where they take the skull cap off of the skull. And there's several procedures that you have to go through, cutting through the thick, dense membrane to get to the brain. And then you have to, there's a procedure where you take long handled scissors and then snip the cords and things that are off the bottom of the skull and things to get the brain out of the head. And he said there was no need for me to do that night because the wound in the head was massive and there was no brain to be removed. So you have differing descriptions of the wounds at differing times, different casket times coming in, that sort of thing. That's why the autopsy is so important. It's just weird from beginning to end.
Yeah, but can I ask you, William, I haven't heard those details and they are fascinating. Is there a suggestion or an underlying suspicion? Number one, it seems bloody incompetent based on what you've said. But is there a suggestion that it wasn't the body? The body had been switched. I mean, you have no doubt that that was Kennedy's body that was there all along the way, or am I missing something?
Well, as Donald Rumsfeld would say, we don't know what we don't know. Obviously, I wasn't there. I have to go on the accounts of different people that were involved. Basically, what this points to is somebody got a hold of the body along the way at some point and did something to the body, and the body wound up in a cheap metal shipping casket and arrived at the morgue before the official autopsy. I know this all sounds crazy, and I get confused as much as I know about it, but I can tell you one thing. The people that I spoke to, they believe what they said. I believe Paul O'Connor when he said there was no brain to be removed. I believe that the body came in a cheap metal shipping casket at 6:35. And we have a report by a man named Boysen who said that the body came in at that time. I independently found another person that was in the morgue that believes Oswald did it. And yeah. I said, what time did the body come in? And without hesitation, he said 6:30.
Yeah.
So how do you square that? How do you square the casket coming in at 6:30 and then have a report from the FBI agent saying that, well, no, we took the body in and it was at 7:17. And then you have another report, the official historic report, that says the honor guard brought it in at 8 o'clock. There was a shell game of some type going on with the president's body for whatever reason.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it does sound like something's rotten in the state of Washington. State of Washington, wherever this craziness seems to have played out. But again, the only thing I can add, I mean, as somebody who hasn't really examined it in any way the way you have, is that there was a royal, there could have been a royal screw up. And I like you at the beginning of your investigation of the opinion that, you know, that there is a conspiracy, and our host Bob is very much in your camp, that something is fishy, but what is it? And I still can't see it. Anyway, thank you for explaining that. You know, as you have said in some of your interviews, you came a bit late to the party, you know, if I can call it a party, and and it is intriguing. I'll just add one other point, because I know we're running down, and Mr. Robert Wilson hasn't had the chance to say a word. I'll just add this: several years later, I can't remember what year, I got a call in California, and my London office said, district attorney in New Orleans is announced that he's going to tell you who killed John Kennedy. So, and for a moment, I have a senior moment, and you can tell me what was the name of the district attorney played in the movie so well?
Jim Garrison.
Jim Garrison. So Jim Garrison, I jump on a plane and I go to New Orleans, and I introduce myself to Jim Garrison, who is going to tell us how he's solved the Kennedy murder, you know, and he goes on at great length about, oh God, you've come all the way from England. And, you know, I mean, I think this is kind of inappropriate, really. Just tell us the facts. And then he does tell us, you know, what he said at that press conference about Clay Shaw and all these people, but so I thought, you know, here is Jim Garrison trying to cash in on notoriety of the case. Anyway, I don't think he did solve the Kennedy assassination, to my memory. But anyway, so I've rambled on a bit, and thank you for your answers. And I don't know if our esteemed leader is still there and would like to come in.
Well, I'm still here, and I was fascinated listening. The point of this was to put your two great minds together, and even a fool is counted wise when silent, so I'm safe until this moment. But, Steve, how much time do we have left in the hour? Steve must be taking a break.
He's gone for a lunch break.
Ivan, would you like to stay on past the hour, or are you satiated so far with today's show?
Let's see. If it's all right with William, I'll certainly stay on for a little bit longer, if that's okay with you. Yeah.
Oh, well, absolutely. Okay.
And then when you're welcome to stay the whole time, and today I think I can facilitate us most by letting you two fellas have it out. But I'd like to pop a question in there. From my friend William. William, Ivo went down, and his description of what happened with Garrison, I believe, is accurate, and a gentleman of his intellect would come away feeling like that from events of that day. But was there anything we can say in Jim Garrison's defense that happened at other times that gave some credibility to what he was trying to unravel? And within that, could you tell us, like, how many witnesses did he lose to death?
You know, I off the top of my head, I don't know.
Well, we know we lost David Ferry, who left two typed suicide notes unsigned.
That's within
24 hours, Eladio Del Valle was gone, who they were trying to pick up just as the case was breaking. So he lost two witnesses immediately. But could you say anything else, point, counterpoint, just in possibly in Garrison's defense, that he was onto something, even if he wasn't able to prove it?
Well, if he wasn't onto something, why were there so many spies in his own camp? From my understanding is that he had been infiltrated by God knows how many people that were working against him. I think he stepped on a lot of toes. Now, was he doing it for his own benefit? There is a probability in that.
I think, sorry, William. My observation was, there was a certain amount of doing it for his own benefit. I mean, he had world center stage for a period of time. Now, I know there's been movies. I think Kevin Costner played him, did he, in the movie by Oliver Stone? I can't remember who did it some years ago. So I think he was I mean, he was on an ego trip. I mean, a lot of these DAs are on ego trips. You know, they want to run for higher office. I don't mean to shoot down the theory in flames, but I've seen some of these leading characters in politics and whatever crime, including the Manson case, who have been dedicated to what they do, but they know that it's their reputation on the line. I'm talking about Vincent Bugliosi in the Manson case, who did a great job in getting Manson convicted, but was a total egomaniac. Was Jim Garrison an egomaniac in that division?
Well, that's not something I can really answer because I never met the man.
Oh, okay.
But he was where he was, wasn't he? I mean, and I do think he took full advantage to whatever he could do to his position. Did he believe what he believed? It depends on who you talk to. I've talked to researchers that were there that said, you know, and that was part of the trial, that said he was a complete phony. On the other hand, Bob has talked to who's the fellow that I'm thinking about? He's blanking in my mind. No, not Dean Andrews. Mort Saul.
So, you mean the comedian Mort Saul?
Comedian Mort Saul. I didn't have that experience. You did, Bob. Tell us about it.
Well, Mort Saul is the only person who ever uttered the immortal phrase to me, "How dare you!" Aside from that, we got along perfectly. No, Mort came on, and many might not know it, but when Garrison's investigate, because it wasn't in the film, I mean, many might not know it, but JFK. But Mort gave up 2 years of his career at the height of his earning power, basically, and he donated his time to go down to New Orleans and help Jim Garrison with the case. So he put his money where his mouth was. He actually was sworn in, had a gun in his own office, I believe. And Mort Saul related to me there was some discrepancy whether Jim Garrison had warned Bobby Kennedy not to hold on until he won the election to look into the death of his brother. And, you know, there were some people said this happened. Some people said it didn't happen. So I asked him straight up, did that happen? And he said he was present at a hotel in New York, and Jim Garrison and he, Mort Saul, and met with Robert Kennedy, and Garrison warned him straight up that if you don't put this information out early, you're going to, you know, possibly be killed. So we know that happened. That in and of itself doesn't prove a conspiracy, but Mort Saul, for what it's worth, was convinced. And, you know, as they were looking into the case, you know, Mort had gone on Johnny Carson. And the reason that Jim Garrison came on Johnny Carson was Mort Saul was on the show, and he asked the audience, would you like Johnny to have on Jim Garrison? And obviously the audience, you know, responded, you know, to have him on. And there's a good interview on there where Garrison, I believe, holds his own and gives up to that point a great insight into what was going on in the case and some of the evidence he was dealing with. I just add in my own opinion that I think, you know, if there was a conspiracy, I believe just by the back of the head blowout of John Kennedy, one of the doctors in Parkland Hospital, Robert McClelland, said he stared into the gaping hole in the back of JFK's head for 12 minutes. There are 14 doctors and nurses who were often cited together who all attest to that wound. That wound was denied later, and they said the back of his head was intact. I don't know how you would explain that away if the back of his head was blown out approximately the size of a baseball and 14 doctors and nurses attest to this. I think that's pretty damning evidence. Then later, J. Thornton Boswell of the Assassinations Record Review Board was called in the 1990s to testify. And they gave him a plastic skull and a Sharpie marker and asked him to draw the wound. And I was fortunate enough to talk to Doug Horn, our friend, who was present for this, working for the AARB. And, you know, he said they were stunned. He took the marker and he drew the back of the head blowout, as was described by 14 doctors and nurses in Parkland Hospital in Dallas. So he was basically, in my mind, that's a mea culpa. So people can, pardon the pun, shoot these things down. But how do you explain the gaping wound in the back of his head attested by all those people? So I hand it back to you guys. But to me, and what you mentioned with the, you know, the body sort of disappearing and coming in a different covering, it's strange things seem to have been afoot, even if Mr. Garrison's case was not perfect, which I don't believe it was. And, you know, anything we do, if we write a book or we have a show, even if it's with pure intention, some of it is to sell some copies. So I don't doubt that, you know, he might have seen it as an opportunity, but that's his job. He's human. And, you know, some of what he said seems to be hyperbole. Then and then again, the other side who had the body had a body with a gaping hole the size of a baseball in the back of the head. By all accounts, the x-rays don't match this. So I hand it back. To me, that, you know, leaves you kind of open mouth with your hands in the air saying what happened.
Can I ask William another question? And again, I don't know if you went into this. Now, I remember...
And just before you do, I just want to remind us, we're at 55 minutes. Now, we can do an extra half an hour, and if you can do part of it, you're welcome to do part of it. We'd like you to stay the whole time. But if we were going to end the show at an hour, we would have 5 minutes, but we are free to go past that, which I would like to do. And you can ask as many questions as you like, sir.
Well, if it's all right with you, I'll ask one more question on a slightly different, not on a slightly different topic.
And whatever you like.
If it's all right with you, I'm racing off. But here's my question. You guys are much younger than I am. I remember so vividly of watching Jack Ruby shoot Oswald. I mean, it was like a true life soap opera. We saw it happen live on television. And the reason I bring it up is, I mean, the first thing or soon after, we said that Jack Ruby, this sort of small-time mobster, suddenly decides to take justice in his own hands. That doesn't strike me as brilliant philosophy for a guy like Ruby, who kept saying, I love Kennedy, and you know the stuff he said. And then I think William had, was it Jim Lavelle, the guy who was handcuffed to...
Lavelle,
who had some interesting stories, although when I saw the interview I think you did with him, William, I mean, he was getting on in years, and he wasn't quite as lucid as he might have been a few years earlier. So my question is to you, William, I mean, how do you feel about Ruby the Crusader wanting to, you know, show the Kennedy family that he loved John, and therefore he decided to do away with Mr. Oswald? I mean, does that scenario fit?
I think it's a fabrication.
Yeah.
I don't think he gave any thought to it whatsoever. It was part of the story. That his lawyer helped him come up with.
Yeah.
Of course, now I don't know, but that's just doing research and studying, and it just doesn't fit. I don't buy it for a minute. Do you?
Okay. No, not really. No. I think knowing the general mood, the personality he was, it sounds like absolute bullshit, if you don't mind me saying. One other thing I'm going to add, and I haven't said this to Bob before, but I was in Cuba 4 weeks ago, and there is no doubt whatsoever that, you know, I spoke to some people who were around at the time. There was a guy who was a government, who was a photographer for Fidel Castro, and he said that Fidel was royally PO'd at, you know, the Bay of Pigs and all that stuff. And I could see. That maybe Castro was behind that, and you know, the popular background is, you know, that he got the mob to do his bidding because the mob wanted to move into Havana, and they wanted to turn a section that I drove along last month into the Vegas of Cuba. So the conspiracy stuff with Fidel behind, and I know that Bob thinks this is very, very, very strong. Right, Bob? Are you still there? Yes, sir.
I'm just trying to catch up.
I mean, you very strongly feel that the Cuban connection was part of the link to the mob connection to get Kennedy.
When all is said and done, there was a Colonel Fletcher Prouty who was depicted in the film JFK by Donald Sutherland. And we became privy through Len O'Sonic, who's a big researcher, to see a letter that Prouty had written. And Prouty's job was basically black ops, which is that whole world where people are taken out and things are overthrown. And what I didn't know until I saw that letter, it was above my level of understanding, was that they had an Operation Mongoose after the Bay of Pigs. And it was supposed to be leading up to another operation such as the Bay of Pigs. Okay. And in that, it was one of the fellows who was involved in all this was General Edward Lansdale. And Lansdale wanted to be the ambassador to Vietnam. Kennedy at first wanted to appoint him. Then he got wind of him and he thought, you know, we almost came to nuclear war. And many people went into Kennedy's disfavor as he was trying to quiet things down so many millions of people weren't nuked. Prouty said to Stone in the letter, which I'm sure many researchers may have seen. It was new to me. Basically, Mongoose was created as a cover in order to train some of the people who might have been involved in the assassination. But Cuba in general, I think Castro would have been crazy to want to get rid of Kennedy and bring in Johnson. He had really nothing to gain by Kennedy going out, who was looking for a rapprochement and was making steps towards that. I think Kennedy was, brought wide awake by near nuclear war. So Fidel Castro, I'm sure, was afraid of invasion. He was afraid of being picked off. He was afraid of the machinations in place to come after him. But Kennedy had alienated Arthur Schlesinger, Kennedy's main historian, had made a remark that startled me, which was, he was basically at war with the intelligence apparatus. The phrase at war is pretty deep. Some have said Kennedy said he wanted a splinter certain agency into 1,000 pieces. I don't think as an entity they would have gone after him, but there are some people who had the capability to do that. Robert Kennedy's son feels that rogue agents are the ones who killed his uncle. And he spoke out about that in public. Many people said, why doesn't he say something? Why doesn't the family say something? So they did say something. Were Cubans involved in it? Quite possibly at an operational level. I don't want to sound like I'm above my pay grade by these terms. But, as far as Robert Kennedy Jr., he has a stake. He has a pony in the race, and he feels that rogue people took out his uncle. Another piece to the puzzle, which is major. This wasn't in the letter from Stone to Prouty. Prouty to Stone, I apologize. William knows all about this. When Oswald was said to go to Mexico City in September, when Kennedy was then killed in November 63, and he visited the Russian and Cuban embassies, and he put on a dog and pony show. Now, they recorded, we had tapped the embassies, so they should have had Oswald recorded and also, his voice. And also there were pictures taken of a man crossing the street to get into one of the embassies, and it's clearly not Oswald. So they say Oswald was nobody. But I think the key to the cover-up was this man who was not Oswald did go to the embassies and met with the Russian head of wet work. There I go dropping those phrases again, which basically means the head of assassinations in the Western Hemisphere. His last name was Kostikov. So the fake Oswald, this was going on. Who was impersonating Oswald? And then I think the ramification was J. Edgar Hoover had a conversation shortly after the assassination. And basically he said, when someone visited the embassy, it wasn't the real Oswald. I paraphrase, but that's basically a fact. So whoever planned it was able to get an Oswald impersonator to go to the Cuban and Russian embassies, put on a dog and pony show, and have him taken note of. And of course, what would the purpose for this be? Well, when Oswald is picked up, he's guilty. And not only is he guilty, if it comes out that he went to these embassies, they could say that the Cubans or the Russians sponsored him, and this could have led to World War III. So we know that that did happen. Now I'm drawing a conclusion that it could have led to World War III, but I don't think it's a quantum leap. But whoever would have thought that up was Machiavellian. So if someone has the power to do that, some of the cover-up, I believe, was benign. You kept me quiet for a while. Now you're paying for it. It's all coming out at once. So whoever had the power to have Oswald be seen at the embassies obviously is high up the food chain, very Machiavellian, very brilliant. You know, it's in an evil way, it's a very brilliant scheme. We know that that happened. When they got wind that Oswald may have been in those embassies, a benign cover-up by many of the people involved may have come into play. I believe it did. In that they would cover it up, because if they say Oswald's in custody and he just went and met with Kostikov in the newspaper, who is Kostikov? He's the head of assassinations. Anything could have happened. So I think that was the key to the cover-up, and it's why the media has covered it up largely to this day. Many people, perhaps not intentionally, it's just been browbeaten into them. So Mr. Garrison wasn't, I believe, prosecuting. When he looked into the crime, a certain factor of it occurred in New Orleans. And that would just be, they call it sheep dipping. Here goes Bob with he's read a book again. But sheep dipping is just making a person look like they're someone else, that they have another identity. So Oswald was sheep dipped to have been a far leftist when he was in New Orleans by an apparatus who would have been probably headed by Clay Shaw, who claimed he had nothing to do with the agency, but he was actually a high paid asset or a contract agent for them for many years. Not active at that time, but who knows? I mean, they say once you're in that, you're in that. And Guy Bannister, the former head of the Chicago FBI, his office was down on Camp Street, 544 Camp Street, which Oswald stamped on his leaflets saying Free Cuba, 544 Camp Street. So this got him into some disfavor when he put the address on it. But what's the long story short? Everyone Oswald ran around with in New Orleans was a far right person. He also was running around with tons of people who might have been low-level people, all connected in some way to different operations against Cuba, against Russia, against leftists in the country. So they're not reporting this, but it did happen. Someone impersonated Oswald going into the embassy. I've gone on about it and described it. Again, you kept me quiet for a while, and here's your payback. But
all right. Well, here's one more payback thing. And then I got one more question. For William. And so here's the thing. I think it's fascinating the stuff you have just talked about, Bob, and I think it's definitely a 9-part Netflix miniseries in there. So my question for William is this. Do you think, and in the research you've done on the Bobby Kennedy assassination, do you think that Bobby believed the mob and Castro was behind his brother's murder?
I can't answer that, but I do believe that he did not believe that it was Oswald, that there was something behind it. And I think that's part of the reason he decided to run for the presidency. So because he said at one point that the only way I'm going to be able to really find out is to be the president. And that's why he ran. And I believe that's why they had to stop him.
Yeah. And I'm going to add a footnote. Many years ago, I was invited to have lunch with a very beautiful lady. And this beautiful lady had just written a book. I forget what it was called. Her name was Judith Exner Campbell.
Oh, my goodness.
Now, the book. Yeah, so I spent a wonderful afternoon at the Hollywood Brown Derby with this lady, who then told me, I mean, she'd written a book. And in the book, one of the things that was astonishing was that she, at the same time, as you guys know, at the same time, simultaneously, maybe not on consecutive nights, but on consecutive weeks, she slept with John Kennedy at the White House, and then she slept with who is the mob leader now from Chicago? Sam Giancana, could it have been?
Yeah. Yes.
I mean, that is just mind-boggling. I mean, so on one night she was with Sam, and then the next night she was with John. So, you know, truth is bizarre. And I think it was borne out because the White House had her as visiting John Kennedy very often. So I guess this is my last question for you, William. I mean, in any of the research that you've done, is any of that stuff going to be involved in what you're writing?
In this next book, it's basically just going to be about you should see this thing. It's already over twice the size of your normal size manuscript, and I'm not done yet. So it's basically just going to be about Bobby's killing. But I am familiar with what you're talking about, and I do believe it. I also have spoken to a number of Secret Service agents over the years, and I've come to believe that may be part of the reason that he wasn't as well protected as he should have been, because there were a lot of agents that were, I don't want to say right-leaning, but they were. And I think a lot of them had lost respect for Kennedy because of his womanizing.
Yeah.
There was one agent named Tim McIntyre who was on the back of John's follow-up car, and he said to me, "I thought the Kennedys were a bunch of users, and I didn't want anything to do with them."
Yeah. But William, presidential womanizing is not unusual, is it?
No, not in any. I'll tell you, I was writing a book with one of those men, and we got into this a little bit, and he said, "Let me tell you something." He said, because I brought this up, and he said, "Well, let me tell you something." He said, "Those guys that are criticizing Kennedy," he said, "none of them were angels, and that includes me."
Yeah.
So that's right from one of the guys that knew Kennedy, traveled with Kennedy.
Yes.
So, you know, some of these guys, you know, had their own reasons for not liking him, but some of them did not.
Yeah. Well, William,
I find it amazing that they have the guy on the back of the car, and he says that to me, the back of the follow-up car. He says, "I thought the Kennedys were a bunch of users, and I didn't want anything to do with them," and it absolutely shocked me.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, William, thank you very much for the conversation. I enjoyed it enormously. Maybe we'll do it again when the book is out. Although I you know, we pretty well covered the waterfront. So if it's all right with you, Bob, I'm going to excuse myself and let you and William go at it again for however long is left. So thank you for your time, and thank you for your insight, William. I appreciate it very much indeed, and I look forward to your next tome.
Well, thank you, Ivor. It was absolutely terrific. It's been great.
Thank you for being here, as always. We both enjoyed it.
Bye-bye.
William?
Yes.
Well, we still have some time. I'd like to ask, we have about 17 minutes left on the clock. When you were investigating JFK's autopsy, what other events that we haven't mentioned jump out in your mind as very noteworthy or things that you think are at the forefront of the evidence?
Involving the autopsy? Well, of course, the brain, the controversy about the brain. Paul O'Connor said there was no brain to be removed, that inside the skull there was a half a handful of macerated tissue. On the other hand, his partner in the morgue that night, James Jenkins, said, "I was handed a brain to infuse that night." Now, we've gone on to do research, and another doctor has been brought in that would know these things, that studied the case and seen the original x-rays and photographs that are in the archives, and he said that the brain looked shiny and grayish and to some extent indented, like it had been, the brain that they're saying was Kennedy's had been in a jar with other brains for some time, which would lead you to believe that it's not Kennedy's brain at all.
And now, that's daunting. And at autopsy, when they weighed the brain, if memory serves me correctly, the brain that they weighed more than a normal male brain would weigh.
Yes.
And yet it was supposed to be, you know, like if we look at Dealey Plaza and how much of the brain was missing, can we account that some of the brain was blown out by maybe in the street, in the car, did it hit someone? Was any brain that we know left at Dealey?
There was a lot of brain fragments left on the backs of the Secret Service agents that were driving the limousine. There were brain fragments and bone fragments and hair left on the back and in the back seat of the limousine. One of the policemen, Bobby Hargis, was hit so hard with spray that he said he thought he was hit himself, and he had a fragment of brain on his upper lip that he took off. It was just an absolute mess. There was brain seen at Parkland. The interesting thing is that the brain as seen in Bethesda, the cerebellum, which sits at the back of the skull and is a different color and texture from the rest of the brain, the cerebrum, and is easily identified, was basically undamaged. And it was a damaged cerebellum that they saw in Dallas. They said it was literally, one of the doctors said, it was literally swinging in the breeze. There's lots of different things. And, of course, you mentioned the fact that the X-rays don't match, you know, the autopsy pictures and things like that. Just incredible stuff. How do we explain all of that?
Can you, I know you know it so well, can you give like an account for the listener who might not have heard this before, some of the discrepancy in the X-rays to even the photos or what was seen by the doctors at Parkland? And I know Dr. Boswell came forward later saying the back of the head was blown out from the autopsy. Any of that?
The wound as seen in Parkland in the head was a small size of a large egg or a small orange in the back of the head. The top of the head was not damaged. The face was not damaged. When the body reaches Bethesda and it's examined, the wound is now some four times larger. It now encompasses not only the back, but the side, and the side, the occipital parietal, and part of the back. And of course, the top is open, and that was not seen in Parkland at all. Now, some say, well, he had a lot of hair, and the blood matted the hair down and didn't move. I wasn't there. I can't say for certain, but it doesn't make any sense. I think you'd be able to tell if the top of your head had been blown open. If you get if you read the descriptions of the autopsy, it looks like somebody has taken a scalpel and parted the top. Read Jim Jenkins' testimony in his book that I did with him at the Cold Shoulder of History. Just incredible. I mean, there's just too many. It should be, from the evidence that we're given, you should be able to track, you know, and things should come together naturally. But the more you study this, the less things come together. They seem to go more apart than together. So that's not
well spoken.
That's not how it should be in any kind of case like this. But in this case, nothing seems to fit. Nothing seems to match. From the time that supposedly Oswald is in that sixth floor window, to the time that Kennedy's body winds up at Bethesda, nothing is cut and dried. Everything seems to be strange about this case.
Well said. And yeah, that is the fact, the more that you get into it. Now, we have about 11 minutes in that time. I'd like to know what you can tell us without giving us any spoilers about the project you're now working on and when the people listening might be able to look for it. It sounds like a fascinating, encompassing work that you're working on now.
This has been the biggest project I've ever taken on. I've gone deeper than I ever thought I could. It may even turn out to be two volumes. Don't know yet. I'm still working on it. I've talked to most of the people that were around Bobby Kennedy that night, that were in the pantry around him that night, that were still living. I've had many conversations with the lawyers, the last two lawyers that he had in the case, and I was somewhat responsible for getting him the lawyer that he has now. I've talked to lawyers extensively. I flew to New York to meet William Pepper. I told him what I wanted to do. I wanted to get in on the case, and he said, "Well, you can, after having lunch with me and talking to me, going all the way out there," he said, "we'll make you our West Coast investigator. That way, if we can get a new trial, they won't be able to call you up and just ask you anything they want, which they will do if we don't make you part of the case." So, they did that. It's just been an interesting, and it's been more than interesting. It's just been an amazing trip down the yellow brick road, so to speak. And why I use that analogy is I have a story in the beginning of the book where I first go to California, and we're going down the road, and Mark is telling me about some of his time in Hollywood, sound stages that he's been on. And at one point, he said, years later, he was on a sound stage at MGM. And he's talking to one of the grips that work there. And he said, "Maybe we were talking about the history of the studio." He said, the guy says, "Hey, you want to see something?" And he says, he takes me way back to the back of the stage. It's a great big massive stage. He says, he takes me clear back where it's dark. And he takes a long-handled crowbar and he pries up some of the floor. And he says, "You see this?" And he says, he shines a light. And he said, "I'm looking at all these red bricks." He said, "You see that? That's the yellow brick road. It was the original yellow brick road from The Wizard of Oz. It still existed at that time." And
Wow.
Mark was getting to see it. And so I equated that to taking our own journey down the yellow brick road. And that's basically what it turned out to be. We were just trying to get as many people, witnesses to the event as we could, and figure it out as we were going and learn as much as we could and see what we could find out. And it was quite a journey. It should be out in the fall of next year or the spring. I'm not sure exactly. Depends on how fast I can get it into the publisher. So we'll see.
We'll all be looking forward to that. If we don't want any spoilers, but keeping that in mind, I'll ask a question that I think isn't a spoiler. But what piece of evidence that remains would you say really stands out to the fact that we should be concerned what happened in Bobby's death? Is there something that stands out among the other evidence that really is one that makes you look at it and say, you know, what happened here?
The fact that here once again we have a Kennedy running for the presidency and he's killed. And some people will go, "Why does that matter? You know, people die all the time." You know, we can't afford to have our politicians assassinated. We need to have truth in our history. And we've seen, I believe, massive cover-ups in the death of John Kennedy, and I believe it was a cover-up in his brother's murder. And we can't let this stuff happen. We've got to hold government or whoever was responsible accountable for what happened. We can't have our futures decided by assassination. we the people should have our vote and vote these people in and out of office as we see fit. And I believe that that choice was taken away from us in 1963, and that choice was taken away from us in 1968. And that's why it's important. We need to watch everything, question everything when it comes to the government. Does that answer your question?
Yes, sir. It answers it very well. And we have a few minutes left, so 5 minutes. I just wanted to ask, had bullets not been able to take out John, Bobby, and Martin Luther King, how do you think it might have affected our country? Again, we have 5 minutes, so just your thoughts on it in a nutshell, what we lost when we lost those three men.
I think that John Kennedy would have tried to, if not eliminate, nuclear weapons in our time. You know, he tried with the nuclear test ban treaty. I think he would have carried that forward. He knew what a danger it was. And I think that's part of the reason he was killed, because he wanted to, he turned from being a cold warrior into something else. He realized that these weapons could destroy us all. And when the powers that be saw that he was trying to do something about that, those cold warriors around him decided that he was weak and that he needed to be removed. Same thing with Bobby. I think that, and Martin, I think these guys would have really changed our world for the better. I think that the poor would have been better taken care of, that we would have had programs that really helped people and not to facilitate war so much. But now the war machine is always in this country, is always in full mode. You can always find billions and billions and billions of dollars for war, but let that be for food programs or basketball programs to get kids off the street, to help people that need money or need food, need help with housing. Don't have any money for that, but we sure as hell have money for whatever war we need to go into. I think a lot of that would have been stopped. I think we would have had a totally different way of looking at things, and I think that we would have a totally different country today. I honestly believe that. I believe that there were men that cared and that would have done something about it. But good men often let their guard down, and evil is evil. Evil never sees itself as evil. I'm sure that these people thought that they were right in everything they did. And because of their actions, we're all paying the price today.
Well spoken. And it gives one pause to think about what might have been. I know John Kennedy had the Peace Corps, which has kind of been phased out and isn't brought up in discussion. If
That's
that
right.
had been left around, that could have led a lot of people maybe to get college credit and tuition and in a different mindset and not have to join the armed forces, but, you know, to work for helping other parts of the world. And also the joint space program that Fletcher Prouty had showed documentation on, where the United States and the Soviet Union might have had a joint space program and funneled arms money into. But on those thoughts, we can discuss that another day. Next week, you'll be back on with our friend Joan Mellon on Don't Pass Me By. So I give a great thank you to my friend William, who was so well-spoken in picking the brain of our other friend, the legendary Ivor Davis. So thanks for listening. Come catch us next week, and don't pass us by. And thank you to the Shake and Wake Network.